This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In this summer of record high oil prices, we're going to visit one of the places that your oil comes from. If you took the gas in your car and traced it to its source, there's an increasing chance you would end up not in the Middle East, but in West Africa. You might arrive in this compound run by Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria. A spider web of pipelines stretches out from here, sucking crude oil from dozens of wells. Station manager Joe Kulu wants as much as the wells can produce.
After producing for quite some time, it's like, I'm tired. He said, no, don't get tired. Keep trying. Give us some more.
The United States could use more. The Energy Department says the U.S. depends on Africa for 18% of its petroleum imports. That number is growing rapidly. The biggest African producer is Nigeria, where John Chaplin manages operations for ExxonMobil. He says the giant company is discovering more oil here than in its other provinces, as he calls them.
I was working previously in the U.S., and it's a very mature province, and we're struggling, to replace oil and gas there. In fact, we're essentially in decline in most of our provinces. But here we're in a growth mode, and that's also very exciting. The country's goal is to develop their production or grow their production to about 4 million barrels a day or more by 2010, and it's currently at about 2.4 million barrels a day. So a substantial amount of growth.
Meeting that goal would require dramatic successes from new fields offshore. It would also take stability in a country that often lacks it. Nigerians are debating and sometimes killing over oil money. This conflict is most visible in a place where millions of poor people live alongside a lucrative industry, and we'll visit there all week on Morning Edition. Vast oil and gas reserves lie beneath the coastal swamps of the Niger River Delta. To see much of the Delta, you travel in a small boat. It's a desperately poor region without many roads. And your departure from the port city of Warri feels like a journey back in time. You pass a rusted white freighter called the Western Star. You pass fishermen in wooden canoes. Then you follow a maze of channels through the mangrove forest where tree roots twist up out of the water. When the boat breaks down, as ours did, you're drifting through the wilderness on the tide. This swamp has a lonesome beauty, even though we sometimes spot the sickly rainbow colors of oil on the water. Pipelines run under the surface. Nigeria's biggest producer, Shell, reported 236 oil spills last year alone. Shell blamed some on accidents and most on sabotage. The Niger River Delta is less peaceful than it looks.
We're cruising past a Shell facility where they're flaring natural gas, unwanted natural gas. That means they're simply burning it. An immense flame is pouring out of a smokestack.
Within sight of that Shell facility, we got arrested. A boatload of gunmen came out of the Shell plant to confront us. Some of the gunmen wore civilian clothes. Others had police uniforms. They took us to the Shell facility, said we might embarrass the oil industry, and demanded our audio tape and cameras. All the cameras should be seized, he said. We were finally released after surrendering a blank tape. The industry depends on the protection of the Nigerian police and military. The companies face hostility from gangsters, ethnic militias, even ordinary residents. They all know the oil companies are almost the only source of wealth in the swamp. Their poverty is on the mind of Brian Buckley, a natural gas executive we met in the Delta.
You're talking about a country that has some 135 million people, give or take 10 million as one counts. About 75% are below the poverty line. So it's a country with enormous challenges, enormous problems.
Much of the world first learned of these problems in the 1990s. That's when protesters forced Shell to abandon some of its wells. Their leader was Ken Saro-Wiwa. He was an author who took NPR to visit impoverished villages and oil spills.
There is total poverty here. I mean, it's denigrating poverty, which is totally unacceptable to me, considering that there is so much oil here. They live and sleep oil, but it means nothing to them but death.
Not long after that interview, Nigeria's military government had Ken Sarawiwa tried and executed. He was threatening the government's main source of income. 10 years later, we wanted to learn if anything has changed, so we visited a man who shared Sarawiwa's jail cell. He's a lawyer named Ladum Mati, and he's back at home now. Nigeria now has an elected government. It's now setting up a peace process, Middle East style, between residents and Shell.
But in terms of dealing with those fundamental problems that sparked off the agitations, not much has changed. In fact, people might even say that their lives have remained either stagnant or a little bit backward.
We're hearing a generator outside. Is that your generator?
Yeah, definitely. That is exactly the point I was driving at. We now live in a society in which you want electricity, you provide your generator. If you want security, you get your own security people. So you become the government for yourself.
Mati's neighborhood was going through one of its frequent blackouts. Although the government is building new power plants, many parts of the oil region still have no electricity at all. Energy companies point out that they've spent millions on Nigerian schools and hospitals. They've also paid billions in taxes, but that money has a way of disappearing. Poverty in the oil region encourages unrest, which the government puts down with force.
When we fight, we really fight in this part of the world.
Femi Fani-Kayode is the spokesman for Nigeria's president. In 1999, Delta residents killed a group of policemen, and the government responded with what human rights advocates call an atrocity. The presidential spokesman considers it an example of success.
And where we need to be hard, we have been very hard. We were very tough when it came to a place called Odi Town, where our policemen and our people were killed by these ethnic militants. And the federal government went in and literally leveled the whole place. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It has never happened again since that time. So I think that policy works.
A former oil executive says that Delta's violence grew so bad a few years ago that oil men spoke of leaving. The companies could instead drill many miles offshore, out of the range of the population. Shell and other companies are dramatically expanding their offshore drilling, but oil firms are also investing on land. There's just too much energy to leave behind. Chris Findlayson is a senior executive for Shell.
We have found ways to improve recovery of the fields, but also we have found new fields. Also, we have a lot of gas there. The majority of the readily exploitable gas is found in the onshore and the swamp areas.
You couldn't abandon the Niger River Delta even if you wanted to.
We have no intention of doing so.
Which means the Delta remains a kind of laboratory for managing the risks of Africa's expanding energy industry. We got a snapshot of life in the Delta when we stopped to observe an outdoor wrestling match. Hundreds of people gathered in a circle around two men locking arms on a lawn. This is the perfect entertainment for the Niger River Delta. It's a traditional test of strength and endurance, and it requires no electric power. This is one of the places on which the American economy becomes more dependent year by year. This week, we'll listen as oil companies, Nigerians, and their government wrestle over the wealth beneath their feet. Tomorrow, an American oil company struggles with protests. You can find maps and photos of the Niger River Delta at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.